kid seems to have a dream to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast, the podcast about bakers and bakeries, large and small, and the people that visit bakeries and customers of bakeries and millers and bakeries, bakeries, bakeries. I love bakeries, and I know you do too, and that's why you're listening. So great, I'm glad you're here. This is Mark Dick, I'm your host. Today is a lovely July summer day. While I record this, I've just been outside for a bit of a walk, and it is beautiful today, but not as beautiful as the guest on the show today. Well, he's a good-looking guy, but he's also a really, really nice guy and a very friendly gentleman, and one of my very best bakery friends. It's Jim Williams from Seven Stars Bakery in Providence, Rhode Island, and the guy behind the Backdoor Bakery Project, which we're going to get into as well today. So I'm excited for that, and I hope you really like the talk. We've been talking over the last couple of weeks with some smaller bakers that are just starting up or in their first couple of years. Jim's been doing this for quite a while in Providence with his wife Lynn, and it was very neat to get more insight into his story and how they got together and how they started this really cool bakery. I've been lucky enough to visit there, and I'll tell you what, they're doing the good stuff and they're doing it right. And his entire crew are a lot of fun. Met some really nice folks when I was over to visit back in February. But before I get started, I just wanted to talk for a second about another project that I'm involved in called Prosper City. It's a new type of job site that their primary goal is to help improve equity in the workplace. And what they do to help that is make sure that every single job that gets listed on prospercity.org has a salary or a salary range attached to it. Because it turns out that most pay equity problems start right at the job interview and it's with salary negotiations. So people are starting jobs on an uneven footing right from day one. And it's not always intentional, it's just the way that we've always done it. So they're really trying to fix that. And if you're bakery is looking for staff and you want to start pursuing advertising for people online, why not check out prospercity.org and get the candidates that you need for your job in as fair and equitable a way as possible. And the other cool thing is that because I'm friends with Rebecca, who is the founder of Prosper City, she's given me a coupon code. So if you go to prospercity.org and use the coupon code PROSPER30, you can list as many jobs as you like for free between now and October 1st. So give them a try at prospercity.org, where prosperity begins with equity. All right, so let's get going with the talk with Jim Williams from Seven Stars Bakery in Providence, Rhode Island. I really think you're going to like this. I had so much fun getting caught up with Jim. So here we go. So how are you?
Good, good.
How's the summer in Providence?
Summer has been nice. Started out super hot, but it's been nice. Sort of typical New England summer.
Yeah. You know?
A little bit of humidity, but nice.
Okay. Yeah, it's been nice and hot here, and then every once in a while we'll get a big dump of rain. So we haven't had to water the garden too much, so that's nice.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, I can live with this for sure. So cool. Well, thanks for agreeing to do this. This is a big treat for me.
Of course.
Yeah.
Your show is great. I've been enjoying it.
Oh, thanks a lot. That's awesome. Yeah. And so so what are you struggling with these days? What's the big challenge at the bakery?
The big challenge is well, we're sort of in this growth period right now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And deciding where we want to go.
Yeah.
Wholesale is the easy one, of course.
Okay.
But we're feeling like we need to make some moves. So we haven't really done anything yet, but we're feeling like it's getting more and more expensive to do what we do.
Sure. Sure.
Now we got to pay for it.
Yeah. 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 So like expensive, like, staff and equipment or ingredients or just the whole shot.
Yeah. All the above.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it's probably a standard. Everybody's having the same issues, I guess.
Yeah. So right now, so you're doing, you already do quite a bit of wholesale as well as retail, right? Is that?
We're mostly retail.
Oh, okay.
So we hover around 15 to 20% wholesale. So
okay.
We've got our three retail stores and then we do some wholesale on the side. So wholesale's never been we've always done it, but it's never been real big for us.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah, that's something that I don't have really any experience in wholesale at all. It's other than, you know, a couple tiny little markets that I used to take, you know, seven loaves to, right? There is no cube van was ever in the picture for me.
So right.
I find it fascinating places that have, you know, enough wholesale accounts to make that make sense, if you know what I mean. Like, you know, I guess we just don't have like that sort of restaurant culture, food culture here. It's the bakeries in town that I know of that are going the wholesale route tend to, you know, if they can get a contract at a hospital or something like that, then they're very happy, you know, but it's,
yeah, most of ours is grocery stores. Most
yeah.
of Whole Foods markets right now.
Cool. So. Good for you. So are you from Providence, Jim?
Like, no.
No? Where did you grow up?
I'm from California.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So I'm from California, Southern California, Orange County originally.
Oh, neat.
I met Lynn, my wife, at a bakery in Northern California.
Okay.
And she's from Western Mass.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so she wanted to move back out east and sort of talked me into coming with her.
Oh, good for you. Right on. So were you, like, is baking in your family kind of a thing? Or, like, what did your folks do? No?
No, it's not. It's not in my family. I'm the only one in my family that works in food in any way.
Okay.
I did your typical kid, you know, routine and went through school and what do I do next? Go to college.
Right.
Get what I'm going to do with my life. And ended up with a useless degree in political science. And I was making bread at home just for fun. And then this was early 90s.
Oh, wow.
And then... graduated and was working in restaurants and stuff. And then that was when Bread Alone and Village Baker came out.
Right.
And that's when it sort of switch flipped. You know,
okay. This
could be different, could be interesting, could be maybe a career.
Yeah.
Maybe I could do this. Sounded fun. Yeah.
So what did you do to get into it then? Like inspiration?
Of course I didn't know anything about the industry. I didn't know what you do. But it seemed like from reading those two books, it seemed like the path was an apprenticeship of some sort.
Right.
And of course now I know all you have to do is apply for a job and sort of work hard. but I looked in, the Village Baker had a list of bakeries across the country and throughout Europe. So I sent a bunch of letters out asking about apprenticeships.
Oh, good for you.
Because I thought that was the path. I thought that's what you did.
Yeah.
And got one reply. So it was a small bakery in Berkeley, California.
Right.
So packed everything up and in a car and moved to Berkeley.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
So from there, I just worked in a bunch of different places and sort of started at the bottom and worked hard and showed up to work and did what I was told and it all fell into place.
Oh, good for you. Yeah. So, so what's the big takeaway from that apprenticeship period? Like, just keep your head down and keep going, or,
For me, that was the path. I mean, it was really, it was a little tiny place called the Bread Garden.
Yeah.
In Berkeley. I was there for only about 2 months or so.
Right.
And then, the owner approached me and said, "Hey, I've got a friend with a bakery and we feel like this would be a good place for you. So why don't you go apply?"
Yeah.
So I said, "Oh, all right." I went and applied and got the job and stayed there for a while. That was a place called Semi Freddy's, a big wholesale.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was there for about a year. And then another baker, I'd gone to college in San Diego. So San Diego was sort of a second home for me, I guess.
Right.
And a bakery had opened in San Diego. So I was, I don't know why I felt like I'm going back to San Diego for some reason. I mean, sure. There, a really amazing place to become a baker, but, for some reason, San Diego pulled me back and I ended up going to work for a just starting out bakery called Bread and Sea. I was there for about 3.5 years, I guess.
Right.
And then eventually left there. And there are a few other sort of stops in between. I went from there to a place called Artisan Bakers. I had met Craig Ponsford at a guild sponsored trip to France in 96, I guess that would be. And that's actually where I met Lynn on that trip.
Oh, wow.
So, and then after that, me and Craig sort of hit it off. And so again, I was ready to move on and I called him up and said, "Hey, I'm looking to move on. Are you hiring?" And he said, "Sure, come on up." So awesome. Packed it all up again and moved to Sonoma.
Oh, okay. So, oh, neat. Yeah. Well, cause, it's funny because when we were out in Wheatstock and you were running your class out there in February, because I know Craig a little bit, right. And there's, the way you two were sort of connected, during the class and just the odd comment and stuff. It was like, okay, you guys are speaking the same language at a slightly different level, you know, than, like there's baker language and then there's two guys that have hung out together. So that was cool.
Yeah. He was probably, was my first sort of real proper mentor, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
And then I left, of course, and we stayed friends and friendly and
yeah.
You know, it's one of those kind of friendships where you see somebody once every 5 years and you sort of fall back into where you were 5 years ago kind of thing.
Yep. Yep.
But yeah, Craig's a great guy and he's a friend and
yeah.
Taught me a lot and all that. So. Yeah.
Very generous fellow for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool guy.
Cool. So when you, so you meet Lynn in Paris, sparks fly, she's moving to, and then, so she's saying, "Hey, we got to go to Massachusetts." Is that sort of the,
well, not exactly. No? So we met on that trip in 96.
Right.
And we spent a day together, but you know, and it was one of those things. We've all probably had them. There was something there, but nothing happened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then we ended up working together at Artisan.
Oh, cool.
She came shortly after I started.
Yeah.
And she was there for about a year or so, and nothing ever happened between us. We were just friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then she left to go on another adventure, and I stayed, but we stayed in touch, and she got to where she was ready to plan a business and plan a bakery, and she wanted to do it closer to her parents and in back east, and they had retired to Jamestown, Rhode Island.
Okay.
And so Rhode Island looked great, and Providence looked great, and she found an amazing building, and all the while we stayed in touch, and she asked a couple times if I wanted to come back and help her. So it was really her business. And finally said, "Yeah, timing's right. I'll come back."
Awesome.
But we weren't together at the time.
Right.
And, once, once I got to town, we realized it was about a little more than a bakery.
Yeah.
But that's timing, right? That's how it all works.
Yeah, for sure.
We opened January 2nd, 2001.
Okay.
So we're approaching, I guess we're in 17 and a half years now.
My goodness. Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and so your first place, that was the one on, is it Hope Street?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hope Street was where we started. That was the building that Lynn found and bought.
Mm-hmm.
And, we had a bakery in there once upon
a
time. We were there for the first 6 years or so, six and a half maybe. And we just outgrew it. We got to a point where we either needed to get bigger or smaller.
Right. Yep.
You know, we couldn't sort of stay where we were at. It was a really amazing location. The timing was right. Right when we opened, our customers sort of decided what kind of business we were going to be.
And, yeah.
We quickly became sort of a neighborhood meeting spot.
Okay. Yeah.
And so that's what drove the business from the beginning to now. So
nice.
Yeah. So we had production space that we sort of lost to tables and.
Right.
So we outgrew the space. It was time.
Yeah. Well, then you have one of those massive communal tables in your place that I love. That was always my dream. My place, we never had enough room for even two chairs. But I was always dreaming about, okay, well, when we're not in production, how can we use like the workbench as the communal table, right? Which is never going to work. But that was sort of I had that picture in my mind of the same kind of thing. It's like, well, yeah, the book clubs can meet here and the community association can meet here and then they'll be well fed and stuff. Right. But, that's neat.
Yeah. I love having places like that to go.
For sure. For sure. Well, and Providence is, I didn't know anything about it till I went out there, but it's a pretty, pretty hopping city, you know, for the university crew and stuff. And, there seems to be an awful lot going on there. Like it seems pretty vibrant to me anyways.
Yeah. It's a nice little city. It's a good size city. You know, it's not overwhelming in any way.
Right.
There's very little traffic. People are great. Yeah, it's a nice place to live.
Yeah.
Nice.
Cool. So then when it's time to do the expansion, is that when you move to where you are now for production?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So we needed to move, and we sort of kicked around a lot of ideas. Do we buy a building and have a little bakery and a retail store? Do we just go, you know, strictly production only? Like, what do we do?
Right.
And we looked for a long time, and we were limited in spaces just because we wanted to stay close to what's called the east side of Providence, where
okay. Hope
Street, we saw that as our sort of center, you know, and we didn't want to be far from that. And so that's how we ended up in the old mill building that we're in now. It was close.
Yeah.
And it worked out well for us.
Yeah. At the time, like, so that's a, you know, this beautiful old brick building, like a massive, was it like a warehouse or what was that originally?
So it's been a bunch of things over the years. The last thing it was is a big candy factory.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then it had been abandoned or vacant for 10 or 15 years until a developer purchased it.
Okay.
With the grand vision of turning it into what you saw when you were there.
Right.
A big building of mixed use tenants.
Yeah.
And so we were actually one of the first, I think we might've been the first tenants in that building.
Oh, nice.
When we looked at it, it was a wide open space. There were no walls inside. The floors were all sort of varying degrees of destroyed old wood floors.
Right.
And they basically rented it by the column. You know, how many columns wide do you want it? So we settled on the size that we did and were able to design the whole thing any way we wanted,
right?
More or less around the columns.
Yeah, sure.
Which is challenging. I swore there was no way I was going into a building with columns.
But, oh, really? Okay. You know, yeah.
That's the way it goes.
Yeah, I guess that would be one of the, on the one hand, like I'm in my imagination, it's like, yeah, you've got this blank canvas, but it's not completely blank by a long shot because there's all the columns holding it up.
Yep.
But yeah, but still it must have been a neat experience to actually say, okay, well, I've got all this experience in my back pocket, and now let's design, you know, as close to the perfect place as we can. Right. Like how did that, did it kind of work like that, or big learnings once you got going?
Yeah. When we were planning the space, I talked to a lot of different people about spaces and equipment and, you know, all kinds of different things. And I can't remember who it was. Someone along the way said, yeah, you have to design at least 4 bakeries before you get it right.
Great.
And I think that's probably accurate.
Yeah.
There's things we definitely would have done differently. And it's challenging when you're dealing with big pieces of equipment like ovens and walk-ins and that kind of
sure.
stuff. You can't move once they're exactly. there. But I think we did an all right job with the space that we had and the limitations that we do have some limitations in that we have a small loading dock, but anything that comes in on a big truck, pallets of stuff,
right,
come in at sort of a main communal loading dock down the parking lot and then okay. go down the hallway. So we had to have access for that. So you know, by the time you sort of factor in all the goofy little stuff that comes up and try to fit this puzzle around
yeah. where
it might be 10 years later.
Yeah. Yeah. And not say, oh, I'm going to have to rent the entire building just to make it all work or something like crazy like that too.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Funny. Yeah. Well, yeah.
It's a fun process though.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, ours was so much smaller, but I used to, our oven was on wheels and I got the electrician when he wired it in to give me, you know, a very, very long bit of slack on the cord that was down in our crawl space. Cause it was, you know, one of those big cables. And because I said, like, we can't move the oven across the room or anything like that, but I can see us having to move it a foot this way or a foot that way as we get going. And we redesigned our little place, I think 4 times in 5 years. It seemed like every Easter after the rush would, you know, we'd close for a couple of days to get caught up on sleep, and then we'd spend the day rearranging the benches and, you know, move this closer and that further away. And as you got into the workflow, so
yeah, that never ends.
No, for sure. Well, and every time you add more staff or what, in our case, one more person, it's like, oh, okay, we need a place for this person to work. So we're not running into them because we're not used to having an extra body there. And mm-hmm. so we start rearranging. So you're running like 24 hours a day now? Is that the?
Yeah, we do. We've always run 24 hours.
Oh, okay.
At Hope Street, we probably had the first, I don't know, there was a period where we were retarding bread overnight.
Right.
But for the most part, right off the bat, we lost our production space to tables.
Right.
So we literally had tables all the way. We opened with a Yopis oven, one of those big round Spanish ovens.
Oh yeah.
And we had tables all the way up to the front of that, like literally 2 feet from it. And so every day we would have to take tables down. We basically, you know, took our retail store down every day. So we had this like window of where bakers could get in to start doing their work. And then finish the next day in time to set the store back up.
Right.
What was my point to that?
Oh, just about you're always 24 hour.
Oh yeah. 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 So once we pushed tables in front of our oven, we basically lost, you know, a third of our production space, half our production space. So that pushed us into overnight.
Yeah.
And that was more or less right off the bat.
Yeah.
And we've more or less run the same way for almost 18 years now.
Yeah.
We did have a period, we switched back about 6 or 9 months ago. We had a period where we sort of dabbled in retarding and creating mayhem in the morning, trying to get everything done. And that just didn't work. We sort of had this idea that we could do more than the extra delivery, basically. So we could have product being baked all morning and get it delivered, and it didn't work. So we've gone back to what we have always done, and it's much better, smoother, faster, more efficient.
No, good.
So yeah, we're 24 hours, pretty much always have.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, does that add an extra challenge in staffing, in saying like, I've got to get people to work the night shift?
There are lots of challenges in staffing. And that's definitely one of them.
Right.
But it seems like when we sort of played with this retarding thing and coming in super early in the morning,
yeah,
when we switched back to what we had always done, people were happier.
Okay.
So that seems a little better. And our shifts are, so we run 24 hours. There's always something going on, but we don't have like, first, second, third shift type of thing. We have people sort of transitioning in and out over 24 hours, but
gotcha.
Our sort of main overnight shift is like 7 to 3, 8 to 4, maybe.
Okay.
Kind of thing. So it's that 8 hours. So it at least you're finishing your day when it's dark.
Right.
And I think there's something to that.
Yeah.
The majority of people are not working that. We have like sort of a night crew that is doing that.
Okay.
But it's not, it's bakery work.
Yeah.
And I think for the most part, people prefer to stay up late than get up early.
Gotcha.
In our little world.
Yeah.
Because for us, we had evolved to just to get everything done, and it's insane, but we had evolved to starting at like 1 in the morning.
Right.
Which is just, that's not night, it's not morning, it's somewhere in the middle. And
yeah,
that's just, no one wants to do that. That just sucks.
Yeah.
So yeah. So we ended it.
That's a neat way of putting it. If you can finish still in the dark, you're...
yeah, I think there's something psychological.
I think there is. That. Yeah, for sure.
Working late instead of, I don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, neat. Well, that's a good point. I never thought of that before. So a question that I had was when you get bigger, like you have, and you've got a big production facility and you've got 3 retail stores, and that, sort of 2 aspects of that really interest me is, one is like, how do you as owners stay connected sort of with your customers? And is there the opportunity for that connection, or is that just something that you have to say, well, I guess we don't do that anymore. We're going to be back in the big facility.
That's a really good question. And it's really challenging.
I think, because
Once you spread yourself out like that, you're naturally not there.
And, right. Yeah.
So we feel like that was probably, if there's anything we could have done differently way back when we moved out, we would have built a bakery with a store attached.
Right. Gotcha.
But it's also, sort of the name of the game, I guess. Once you're off site, you're off site.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess it's up to you to be creative in that sense.
Right.
That's my little backdoor project has allowed that kind of interaction, which is really, really nice.
Yeah.
Len spends a lot of time in the stores just hanging out and talking to people and connecting, and, I don't do nearly as much of that because I'm not, maybe I'm not quite as much of a people person. As
right. Okay. Yeah.
To put it mildly, but I do really enjoy my couple hours at my market a week.
Sure.
But yeah, it's challenging, I think, because you're off site.
Yep.
So I think it really takes a commitment on your part to make an effort to make that happen.
Yeah. Well, and I would imagine, and because I've seen through, you know, social media and the like that the stores themselves and the people in the stores are still working really hard at doing that and being the community place and, you know, cause you've got your like running little events or you've got this thing going on or that thing going on that I've seen pictures of anyways that, you know, still make, you know, Seven Stars like this, this important piece of the neighborhood, if you will.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's nice to hear.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the big thing is we really, a lot of our hiring in our stores, especially is personality based.
Right.
And, you know, we really want people that want to work for us that want to genuinely be there and want to sort of commit to customer service and treating people like they're coming into our home.
Right on.
That's kind of what it comes down to. So,
yeah.
If you're, not somebody that likes to treat customers in that manner, you don't stick around very long.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that's a big part of it is, and we give our managers a lot of leeway and freedom to run their stores and in the production to run the bakery. And I think that does a lot, letting your people do their jobs.
Yeah.
And not sort of micromanaging so much. And
yeah.
So I think, I mean, most owners would say this, but I think it's a good place to work. People are treated really well and people seem happy. And, so that naturally goes on to the customer and how they're treated. And
yeah. Yeah. I'm a believer of that it's, they say, you know, focus on your customers, but if you focus on your employees and if they're happy, it projects out, you know, if your employee base is all upset about something that comes across as well. So, you know, it's a nice balance there. Yeah. So then I guess the other thing I've been kind of knocking around is, so in my case, it was my wife and I opened up our place and, you know, the two of us worked really well together and it, and then we hit a thing where, okay, we can only get so big, with what Cindy and I can handle, right? Like there's only so much we can do. How has your team evolved to run something as large as you've got with like three stores and the big facility? What's sort of the partnership look like there? Is it like, how has it grown beyond the mom and pop, running the whole show?
It kind of gets back to letting managers do their jobs.
Yeah.
We have, Sarah Williams. She's no relation to us, but
okay.
She started with us as a kid out of Johnson & Wales.
Right.
And so she's been with us for 13 years now, I think.
Oh, wow.
And we've sort of groomed her and given her the bakery. So she's responsible of it 24/7.
Yeah.
And everything that happens in it. And then she has her team below it.
Mm-hmm.
But her and I worked really closely for many years, mostly on the managing, but the product side.
Right.
And, you know, we got to a point 3, 4, 5 years ago where it was time to let the little birdie fly. I think you get to a point in a business where, especially something like ours that we started and it was just me and Lynn when we started,
they're
now having almost 100 employees. You get to a point where I think a good owner needs to realize that there are people that are better at your job than you are.
Yeah.
It's time to let them do their job.
Yeah.
So that's a huge piece of it, I think, is on the production end, which sounds like you're asking about. On the production end, a huge piece of it is sort of letting Sarah do her job because she's better at it than I am.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, that's
and stepping away and being good at stepping away and challenging. I think she wouldn't mind me saying this. Challenging her in the sense of giving projects, but also letting her fumble a little bit and learning from it. And I think that does a lot. And because of that, she's responsible for it. And I'm not anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's awesome. That's a big lesson to share, really. It's like, if you work so hard to bring people along and to get them where you're working well together and that they're able to take it on. And then you do have to do that last step and actually let them take it on. So,
yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think you have to, it's better for the business and it's better. I think it's better for them. That's why you take somebody that is so talented and driven that they want the responsibility.
Yeah.
It seems to me, to us, it seems foolish not to allow them to have that. So,
exactly.
So the problem, of course, becomes, well, what do I do now? that's been sort of an ongoing issue, but
yeah.
So that's how we do it. And then she's got her team below her and,
Awesome. Well, and so I think this is a good segue. So tell me about the Backdoor Bread project and how did that all get started? Cause I think that's a fascinating piece of what you're all about.
Mm. That started, so going back 6 or 7 years or so, as I was sort of starting to step away from day-to-day production, I was still very involved in day-to-day up until a couple years ago even. But I was starting to step away and, I was missing just making bread.
Right.
Because at my core, I whether it's true or not, at my core, I love it. And I don't know, I don't believe that I know how to do anything else. So, so I started making bread on Thursdays, I think it was. And I would it was just one bread once a week,
right,
that I made, which when you have three stores and 100 employees and all the sort of moving parts that we have, that's sort of a cool thing to be able to do.
Sure.
And I would sort of drive around and deliver it to our three stores and give a little spiel and, you know, whatever, but it was cool. And I was baking again, but it was also, there was a real disconnect between sort of what I was doing and the customers and our employees and being able to explain what was going on. And it was right. A little funny, like, oh, this random bread shows up on Thursdays. And, you know, so, but it was great. I did it for a year or two.
Yeah.
And then we bought our first mill, sometime in like late 2014 or so. And then the Thursday bread sort of evolved into milling for it.
Got it. Okay.
And I had some ideas on things that I wanted to do. And slowly through that, I was starting to be more and more interested in whole grains. And, mm-hmm. Me and Lynn sort of just got this random idea. Well, what if you make a few breads and open the back door of the bakery, which leads into this hallway where there's a winter farmer's market.
Right.
So there's hundreds of people that come to this market, and see how it goes. So I was like, huh, all right, I'll do that. And of course, Lynn's, you know, I'm very like, oh, I'll just open the door and sell some bread. But Lynn's like, she wants to brand it. It's got to be something.
Yes.
It has to have a name.
Yes.
So that's how Backdoor Bread came from, because it is the back door of our bakery where we take deliveries, but also where the market happens.
Right on.
And it was only going to be whole grain, and bread sold. I think the first day I just opened the doors, and in a couple hours I sold 80 loaves of bread. Like, wow, maybe there's something here. So that's how it started. So
oh, cool.
And so I did that whole winter market. So this was I just did the third year. So that was 3 years ago, I guess that started. So I've done that three seasons. And then the last, including now the last three seasons, it moved to Wednesday afternoons.
Okay.
At a market that happens Wednesday afternoons here in Providence.
Gotcha.
A customer told me last week I need to change the name to Outdoor Bread when I do that. Yeah. So, and then somewhere along the way, we've gotten really lucky here in the Northeast with varieties of wheat that are just growing. People are growing cool stuff
and access
to stuff. So I didn't plan it, but it evolved into a single variety wheat thing.
Right.
And that wasn't my plan, but it's definitely where my passions led.
Yep.
So that's how it's become what it's become.
Sure.
Somewhere in there, I think winter 2016 was when we got Andrew's mill.
Okay.
So we have one of his first 40-inch mills, because we had a little Osteroller and
right.
Just the day I took it out of the crate, we knew we outgrew it.
Yeah, I remember some emails that you sent on the guild group about that when it first when you first got that one.
Those mills are horrible.
Yeah.
sorry to anyone listening that has one. They're horrible. But we struggled with that it probably took 6 months, and I contacted Andrew and I was like, hey, you want to build me a mill? And surprisingly, this was before he was really, he was considering turning it into a business.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But he was like, sure. And I was like, really? All right. Cool. Let's do it. So, by the time his mill came, it was like we started milling and the whole bakery just changed. It's sure. Like a game changer. We're really doing this now.
Yeah.
Then the backdoor thing got a little more serious because we had a proper mill now that was making amazing flour and, I could really start making the kind of bread that I wanted to make and eat, and customers understood and
Well, that's fantastic. It's when I was out there and we were doing the classes and just trying the different single variety grains that you had for that class, that blew my mind. That was my whole reason for coming out to Wheatstock, was to try and really be able to taste the difference and see what all the fuss was about that I was reading about, and it just locked in. It was so cool because I was able to now make contact with a couple millers here and get, I've got Red Fife and I've got some Kamut and I've got two different types of spelt now that they don't know the names of, but I can tell the difference of, right? And so we're, I'm working on, you got to tell me the name, we got to figure out the name of this, because it's going to help a lot in describing it to people, right? But I'm still working on the technical aspects of getting consistent, decent loaves with the 100% whole grains, but the flavor is just amazing. And I had no idea. Even something like Red Fife, which isn't a new thing in baking circles, a lot like people have been raving about it that I know of for 10 years or whatever, but I never really got it until I came out to Wheatstock. So, and now it's people are asking for it. When I ran out of Red Fife flour, it's like, well, you're not making it, like, what's going on? And I thought that was cool.
Awesome.
Yeah, that was like, and I'm still, I'm still like apologizing for the volume and stuff that in the loaves, but they're like, it's fine. It tastes great. So let's go. So that's neat. Well, yeah,
I would like to see whole wheat disappear.
Yeah.
Just this sort of generic idea of whole wheat. What is that?
Like, yeah.
You can have five different red wheats on a table, which is generally in North America, at least, where our whole wheat flour comes from, right? It's a blend of red wheats. And they all taste different. They all smell different. They all ferment different. They all behave different. They're different.
Yeah.
This idea of like generic whole wheat flour to me is, it makes sense why it exists, right? It's
right.
blended for spec and consistency and everything else.
Yeah.
But it'd be pretty cool if we can start thinking about varieties and how different they all are, and some work for this and some work for that. And
yeah. Well, it's like when you go to the wine store and it's, you know, you can buy the gallon of white, or you can buy the nice bottle of Shiraz, or the nice bottle of Gewürztraminer, or whatever you like, right? So, yeah, so cool. So, I think it's just a really neat thing. Like, so I imagine that by doing it the way you did with you know, single variety wheats with the backdoor bakery, that it also kind of lets your customers of Seven Stars have what they're used to. Are you working on transitioning more whole grains into the big bakery?
We've sort of done this in phases. So when we first started milling, we sort of bumped everything up in all of our breads,
right?
And then we sort of let that go for a while, and then we started getting some white wheat in.
Okay.
And that allowed us to use a little more.
Yeah.
And now what we do now is Sarah has just gotten really good at making whole grain pastry type stuff. So we pretty much always have a seasonal tart with our spelt crust, and we have a bunch of different cookies, like shortbread style cookies that we do. And so that's kind of what we've been doing more than anything else lately.
Nice.
But it's really challenging when you've been around as long as we have, because customers have their favorites.
Yes.
And they don't like their favorites to change.
Yes.
So, so we have that as a challenge, but it's almost, in some ways, it's almost easier to tweak what we do already.
Right.
Than create new things, unless it's something completely different, like a tart. Like, we never did tarts before.
Gotcha.
So adding that was really kind of easy and really delicious. It's really amazing. So
gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. My transition for that is my one miller is doing like a high extract white flour, like the 85% white flour. And I'm starting to bring that in more and more, as a replacement for the unbleached, hammer mill flour I've gotten, and just to, you know, get it going slow but sure. But you're right, there's a couple of things that, you know, my cinnamon raisin bread I think is going to be a white cinnamon raisin loaf for a long time still, because that's sort of my once a month here's the treat. You know, go crazy. But yeah, cool. So and so now you're off to the grain gathering, is that?
Yeah, we're leaving tomorrow.
Yeah,
yeah, in Washington.
Yeah. So what, have you been out there before?
Yeah, I've gone the last 3 or 4 years, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah, so I usually go every year.
Oh, nice. Nice. So what's, tell me a bit about that, because I've not been out there before. What's, what goes on?
So it's at the Bread Lab, which is an extension program of Washington State University, in Burlington, Washington. It's sort of surrounded by wheat fields and farms in the Skagit Valley.
Yeah.
And it's a very low key, mellow.
Oh, nice.
Group of people that come. I mean, it's organized, but it's very loosey goosey. And I think that's part of what makes it so great.
Sure.
It is whole grain biased for sure.
Yeah.
But not 100%.
Right.
And there's everything from, people doing bread to, there's a woman that comes and does rice almost every year, or buckwheat.
Okay.
Asian woman. And then they have people from the industry that come. There'll probably be a scientist or two there.
Right.
Discussing something either bread related or grain related, or
yeah.
And it's just a really fun loosey-goosey, but organized event, if that makes sense.
Awesome. No, it makes perfect sense. That's sounds very Pacific Northwest, BC kind of a thing.
Yeah, weather's usually beautiful this time of year.
Oh, man. I got to get out there next year. That'll be fun. Yeah, for sure. And are you hanging out for a little bit after or just going out for the event?
We're so the event is Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then me and Lynn will go to Seattle for a couple days.
Nice. Fun. Yeah, so. Oh, good. Good for you.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Yeah, like I saw Dr. Jones's presentation at Wheatstock sort of kicked off the week for me, and he completely blew my mind. So
he's a cool guy.
He's a really cool guy. So I mean, I've got a call out to him to say like, hey, once this event's calmed down, come and let's chat because I'd love to learn more. Yeah. But the he showed a picture of he said variety can be beautiful. It was I think the picture, and it was sort of the here's all the sampling of the grains that they're trialing, and it was like and still on the stalks and everything, right? And they looked. Every single one looked so radically different than each other. You know, there was like that traditional head that's on the Saskatchewan, you know, coat of arms or whatever, right? Is like, no, that's nothing one like- of, that's one of like, you know, 30 different grains. And it just, that blew my mind so much that I said, I want to go see some of this in action for sure. So
cool. Yeah, you should. If you come next year, you'll have to make sure you do his early morning walk that he does.
Oh, really? Okay.
He does a walk at like 4 a.m. or something, just like a sunrise kind of thing.
Yeah.
And through the fields. And so you get to see everything from whatever they have graining or growing in their test plots to random animals that are out. And
sure.
It's really fun.
Oh, that'd be a blast.
Cool experience.
Yeah, I haven't gone walking in the field since my grandfather was alive. So that's that'd be awesome. So cool. Well, like I hope you have a great trip. That well, you, how can you not? But have an awesome time.
Thanks.
And it's been so neat talking to you and hearing the story from start till now for sure. So I know, you know, I should mention for the record how much, when I had my shop, how much I appreciated you and our interactions on the Guild E group and stuff. There were so many times where, you were on there either helping someone else out and I was taking rapid notes because it, oh, this is great. Or just helping me out directly with issues I was having. It was, It was so nice to finally meet you this year and to actually put a face to all of the emails that we were swapping back and forth over the years.
That's always fun to do.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Thanks for your kind words.
So I really appreciate it. And I wish you well, of course. And I'm hoping to get out and spend more time out in that Rhode Island area. It was a lot of fun when I saw you this spring.
Yeah. So, anytime.
Cool. Come out anytime. Right on. Well, thanks. Good luck, safe travels and all of that. And I hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark.
And there you go. That's Jim Williams. Good talk, eh? I really liked him a lot. I've known Jim for quite a while via email and recently had more time to talk with him. And I love chatting with him. He's a really good guy. And if you're out at the grain gathering this weekend, why not stop and say hi and say, hey, I heard you on the podcast. And I hope you have a really good time out there if you're going, or if you're at the kneading conference in Maine, I hope you have a really good time out there. And you know what? If you're just at home baking, I hope you're having a really good time at home baking because that's what it's all about. So have a great week. Happy baking. And we'll talk to you next time.